Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Today we're joined by the Executive Director of the Evansville Department of Metropolitan Development, Philip Hooper. Welcome back to The Trend.
Thank you, Micah, for having me. It's great to be back.
And we're going to talk about a range of things today. You're going to make your case for urban living, but I want to start with sort of what's been in the news. And that is, once again, we're hearing about the possibility for a downtown hotel situated behind the Ford Center in downtown Evansville. And the latest news is that there are five companies that you are considering to, I guess you're not yet at the point where they're issuing proposals, but you're sort of looking at these companies and seeing if these are the right teams to work with.
That's correct. We are at an exciting point where we're reviewing the responses to the request for qualifications. Five teams responded that have billions of dollars of recent and current hotel and convention expansion experience. And it's a great place to be in. This is exactly where we wanted to be when we announced that we needed to do a more thorough process with soliciting developers and researching the market data for financing and for our city and for the development goals of the city. And we're excited to be here.
This has been a pretty tedious process with several false starts and then an expensive $70,000+ study to see what the feasibility of this hotel is. What makes this different now? How do we know that we're actually going to wind up with brick and mortar happening?
Well, I wouldn't say it's expensive. You put it in context of the total development cost. It's a fraction of a percent to do a very needed due diligence to understand in an independent way the deal. You can feel more confident that the process that we went through for that agreement with Hunden Partners, as Chicago company with Indiana Roots, is you can feel better in that we have nationally significant experience at the table in a development situation like this. Why wouldn't you want to have the folks with the most access to capital and the most experience on their belt to help you solve the problem? So we feel very confident about it.
So you're talking about the companies who potentially could wind up building the hotel versus some of the local companies that were involved at various other points of the process.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the fact of the matter is we have a lot of experience at the table that is great. I mean, that's a great thing.
What about costs to the city? What are you looking at there?
Yeah, there will still be a significant cost of a gap versus what it will cost to build the development and what its market value will be. That is to be fine-tuned through the proposal process that we're about ready to enter. And again, that's why that cost of that report or the analysis that we conducted with Hunden Partners is so important, because before we spend $10 million± of money from our development toolbox that is the public's money for certain things. You know, this is the kind of money from the downtown redevelopment area that's for downtown. But we want to make sure that we're using it in the smartest way possible. And that's what we've done here. And it's worth every penny. And the experience you see at the table is the first proof that this is a better process. And we should all be looking forward to seeing what comes out of this.
And you mentioned the request for proposals coming out a little later this month. And then just in broad strokes, what's the process? What kind of a timeline are you on?
Yeah, we'll ask a short list to come back. It could be one, could be two, three, could be all five to ask to submit specific proposals and go through that process. And we'll know that number and who and announce that at the next Redevelopment Commission meeting potentially. It could be before, but it'll at this point probably likely be at that next regularly scheduled meeting on the 21st. By October, we'll have those proposals back. And by November, we'll be selecting a developer and moving forward and breaking ground.
What role will this hotel play in your greater vision of Evansville's center?
It'll make our downtown stronger. It'll be another destination. It will allow the convention business to fully compete for convention business, and that is a huge economic impact to cities that have convention businesses. And right now, without the hotel next to the convention center, that's a big limiting factor.
Well, we want to talk also, of course, about your case for urban living, and this strong city center seems to be a really kind of a at the center of what makes a city strong, that you have to have this core. At least that's the case that you make.
Yeah, and I'm not alone in that. And for decades now, we've been, you know, learning mistakes and lessons from our past development practices, and it's a common adage that you can't be a suburb of nowhere, and you know the heart of your region is critical to the health of your region, and so while people may choose to not live in a downtown environment, as the mayor and his wife have chosen to live in the downtown environment, my wife and I have chosen to live with our family in the downtown environment. You at least need to be rooting for that city and rooting for that downtown, because it is critically important economically and socially and culturally to the health of your region.
Philip Hooper, I have to ask you, cities are growing. We see all these demographic shifts, lots of people, especially younger demographics, moving back into city centers and so forth. Why do you need to come on and make a PR pitch for living in the city if that's what's happening even on a global level?
If that's what I'm doing now. you know, it's important because I think Evansville has a lot of urban assets that maybe we don't realize or appreciate, and we've got to do a better job selling those and a better job competing. You know, competing is a funny word because it's like us. It's sort of inherently conflicting. You know, you're competing against something, you know, and there's some of that that's just healthy. Sometimes I like to say cooperation, you know. You know, absolutely, we're rooting for the region. But it's important because I think as I said, I think we don't fully appreciate the better starting block that we have. If you read Edward Glaser's book, one of the best economists alive today, recent book last year published, Triumph of the City, in which he talks about cities being our species' best invention. You can read some horrific demographics of Detroit, Youngstown, Ohio, having lost half their population since 1970. And despite those horrific demographic realities, those cities are making some great strides. And we have a great starting point as people are coming back to the city. One of those is, and again, I mentioned this last time I was in the air, it's kind of funny to say, well, we're less abandoned than another place, yay, you know.
Uh-huh.
But that's absolutely critical, because abandoned property brings down surrounding property values, increases the cost of public service delivery for police and fire. It is absolutely critical. And you look at some real quick stats. From 2000 to 2012, Indianapolis, as much success as they've had in downtown and urban revitalization, they oversupplied their housing market to the tune of well over two houses for every family. They grew their population by 47,000 people. You take that for the family unit, 18,000 plus more dwelling units needed to house that population. They built well over 40,000 dwelling units as they added 18,000. So they're oversupplying, they're bleeding out. And Evansville, Vandenberg County really stayed healthy. That's not to say we don't have a blight problem. We do. Houses downcycle. They go from ownership to rental to bad rental to abandonment. You know, there's property downcycling. But Vandenberg County and Evansville added 7,700 people in 10 years. And you look at the median household size, added the need for 3,000 more houses. And they netted 2,915 more dwelling units.
So we're right on target.
Yeah. Now, again, that's not to say we don't have an abandonment problem. Mm-hmm. We do. There's many other factors in this. But the quick gut read is we have such a stronger starting point. I mentioned that we're a strong little city. Even that is a great thing to mention, that we are the threat of abandonment is much less per capita for Evansville than it is for some of the other cities.
We're going to take a short break here. We're talking with Evansville Department of Metropolitan Development Executive Director Philip Hooper, and more in just a minute. You're listening to The Trend on WNIN.
On Monday, August 27th, two of NPR's best talk programs are coming to WNIN-FM. The Diane Rehm Show from 9 to 11 a.m. Central Time each weekday and On Point from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. We're also expanding our local news with newscasts each hour throughout the day, along with other informative and entertaining local content. Next Gen WNIN. It's live, local, and the best of NPR.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, talking with Philip Hooper. He's the executive director of the Evansville Department of Metropolitan Development. And you were talking about blight and sprawl being certainly being an issue in the center city here in Evansville. Why is density such an important thing for a city? And even though, you know, the statistics that you gave earlier about the amount of overdevelopment in, say, in Indianapolis versus Evansville, even so, there is a bit of, if you look at projections, there's quite a bit of creep. And in terms of how much land people are using per family, we have bigger yards now than we used to. And so there is a lower density than there was, say, you know, 50 or 100 years ago. How do you reverse that? And why is density so important?
I'd say the first thing that comes to mind is walkability. That when you're in a dense environment, there's an efficiency there that reduces your time in an automobile, which is dangerous. I'll get to that in a minute. And there's new studies out this year from a psychological standpoint. People who live in walkable areas are happier, and they think it's not just, you know, random correlation. I mean, they think there's a causal relationship there. So it's healthy. When you're in a dense environment, you're able to, there's an efficiency and a walkability there that's really strong.
But you can go for a walk in a subdivision too.
Yeah. One of the things I like to think about is how many places are you walking past per 10 seconds? And there's a built-in safety that biological anthropologists argue is we're hardwired to sort of feel safe in certain environments. And when you're out sort of on the plane and nothing's there to protect you, you know, the predators are going to get you. And you can disagree with evolutionary
neighborhood
psychology,
dogs, perhaps.
Yeah. But there is a interest level. I mean, why are 99% of all bed and breakfasts in walkable, dense old areas? Mm-hmm. You know, there's something there that's real. And we have that. So it's great.
And commuting, of course, is a big issue for a lot of people in this area.
It is. You know, one thing to highlight is that we do have an urban job center, which is important. Some of the recent trends about people moving back to the city are sort of predicated on the job center. If your job center's out, spread out, the future for a dense city is and the ability for folks who are looking for a dense city to be satisfied where a environment of jobs is spread out is going to be harder. But when you have a dense job center like we do, you know, we have Indiana's largest private employer just across the highway from downtown. We've got other large employers that are downtown and a beautiful riverfront. We have that there. So that's important. But then the reason job centers is also important is you spend a lot of time in your automobile every year. And that's one of the misperceptions of urban living, that it's dangerous and you're safer in the suburbs. Unless you're involved in a life of crime on a regular basis, you are much more likely to die in a car accident. I mean, it's grim and it's brutal. But you ask folks in a room to raise their hand if you know someone who's been killed in an act of gun violence or wounded, and see how many hands raise. You know, even in a gritty urban environment, the number of folks who then you ask the following question, raise your hand if you know someone that's been killed or wounded in a car accident. Even in a urban neighborhood with a lot of crime issues, you're going to see more people raise their hands on the cars. And so commuting less, living close to work saves you money, it saves you time with your family, and it's safer.
I want to get back to what you said about the dense urban center, the job center, having that at the center of the community rather than in outlying areas. What do you do if a new company comes, a site developer comes and says, Evansville might be a good place for us to start this new branch of our company? How do you make them consider locating in the center of the city versus somewhere on the periphery?
Well, some of our economic and redevelopment toolbox was created just for that, with this recognition that the heart of the city is absolutely important. And so there are certain redevelopment tools that either exist, like around downtown, part of South Jacobsville, just north of the Lloyd on Main Street, that it goes into some of Berry Plastics' property, or the city can consider creating a future redevelopment area to do that. And in state law, built into state law, based on how they can be created, it is a tool for that. So you can offer incentives through there that only apply to that area. You have wonderful folks like Carolyn Rusk that work at the city that focus on brownfield property that understand how to take advantage of certain EPA cleanup grant opportunities and things to help level some of the playing field that in an existing urban environment or suburban environment, anywhere where a business has gone away and left an environmental mess, how to level that playing field as well. And we work through those toolboxes to make those things work out.
So when you say level the playing field, does that mean that it's normally cheaper to build new than it is to redevelop?
Yeah, I mean that, you've got the suburban development offers a great competitive product. You've got one maybe giant parcel with a clean slate and one, maybe retiring farmer. It's all good. He's maybe going to pay for his grandkids to go to college or just retire. And that same footprint in the city is maybe going to have 200 property owners that own 250 parcels, and there's going to be old abandoned foundations in the ground you got to think about, and maybe environmental remediation that's got to happen. And so those are some of the limiting factors that you've got to try to level that playing field.
What are the biggest challenges that you're facing now in your office in terms of revitalizing Evansville City Center?
I think the biggest challenge could still really generally be this civic self-confidence that Evansville feels kind of bad about itself. We talked about that the first time I was on the show, where people feel like, I got to get out of the city. I got to get out from where I'm from. And some of that is like a rock and roll thing, And I thought of another rock and roll quote, but I missed it right now.
You don't have it right now.
But a little more current than I think I mentioned Bruce
Springsteen last time. Yeah.
But to get us realizing and recognizing and celebrating some of these assets in a real way is absolutely critical. The Mayor's Voice Initiative is so exciting for that capacity. There's going to be unprecedented amounts of meetings. Some of the meetings are maybe going to be at 3 or 4 in the morning, so folks that work second and third shift can come,
And just to clarify, this is a new visioning process going to be getting started.
That's right.
Soon.
So there's going to be unprecedented ways for citizens to come and just kind of share what they're excited about, what they're concerned about, what do they want the vision to be, what do they want to carry forward, what do they want to leave behind, that kind of thing. But one of the things we're doing, maybe it sounds like a small way in our office, is to work with this urban, this civic sense of self-confidence and promoting Evansville, is working with neighborhoods to drop things like Front Door Pride as a brand, as a name, because it paints over that urban identity in a really fake way. People don't like fake stuff. People like real stuff.
A neighborhood name.
And more and more, I think this could be a young demographic thing, but people appreciate authenticity. And to say that Goosetown and Culver and Aiken Park, it's just the Front Door Pride area. It's really disrespectful to those neighborhoods. So we're working to make a neighborhood map that's going to be kind of like the Chicago neighborhood map, kind of like the Indianapolis neighborhood map. It's going to be graphically cool. It's still very preliminary. We're right now talking about it with neighborhood leaders at UNO. We're going to be taking it to individual neighborhood associations and talking to the fire departments, public outreach folks, and anybody who's got neighborhood history. We recently talked with the gentleman behind the Historic Evansville website. And we are going to be putting out a great-looking neighborhood map that people will feel proud to hang in their office, hang in the wall, in their apartment or their house, and kind of celebrate that large extent to which a city is competitive over other areas, because we've got those individual identities that have such unique culture and flavor and history.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Philip Hooper is the Executive Director of the Evansville Department of Metropolitan Development, and I'm sure we'll be checking in with you again as time goes on. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I look forward to coming back. Thanks a lot.
And it's time now for the B segment on the show. We turn to our associate producer, Tony Voss.
Thanks, Micah. Today, we have brought Dr. Katie Winsett from USI back, and with her, she has a tale of sheer horror. An organism that grows inside a creature's head. I started off by asking Katie, what is Ophiocordyceps unilateralis?
This is a species of fungus in the ascomycetes. So when you go out in the woods and you see a pretty mushroom, that's a basidiomycete. And so that's a phylum of fungi in that fungal kingdom. Well, another phylum of fungi is Ascomycota, or the ascomycetes. And those include the morels and the truffles and the yeast that you use to make beer. Those are all ascomycetes. So this species of fungus is in that group. It doesn't make a pretty mushroom. It makes an odd-looking ascocarp.
This isn't that vein of sort of, this is a lovely thing to look at. This is a delicious mushroom to eat. This is kind of a gross mushroom.
It's not gross.
Okay.
It's not gross. Instead, we like to use the term very interesting.
It's parasitic.
It is. It is parasitic. And when you see the fungus itself, so when it produces the spore-producing part, it's growing out of the back of an insect.
All right. That's a lot to take in at once. So let's let's rewind a little bit, and let's go back to sort of where this all starts out. It starts from a spore.
All fungi are spread by spores. And so this starts with a spore. The spore will land on the insect that will become its host. And from the spore, hyphae form. And hyphae is the thread-like structures like you would see on moldy bread. So the hyphae form, and the hyphae actually bore into the cuticle of the insect and internally start to proliferate. So you get the mycelium is growing inside of the insect and using the body parts of the insect for fuel to grow. As the mycelium is growing inside the insect, it's eating it up. And eventually the insect is going to die because it's going to lose all of its internal organs. And once the insect dies, the fungus produces its fruiting structure, or the structure that holds the spores. And the spores will then drop to the ground. And so that's the life cycle in a nutshell.
Okay, and this specific one, unilateralis, that we're talking about affects carpenter ants.
A specific kind of carpenter ant that occurs in the tropical forests.
And so what's happening here is that it gets the spore starts producing the hyphae within it, and now this is going to start to affect the ant's brain.
Yes. What we don't understand is how that connection occurs, but the behavior of the ants becomes significant for the fungus. So the ant is going to travel to the optimal site for the fungus to produce its spores. In this case, it's the underside of a leaf. So that the fungus will grow towards the ground and the spore will drop off onto the ground. So the behavior of the ant is very odd, and it goes against the normal behavior of an ant. It will leave its colony, which ants really don't do. These colonies of these ants will grow up in the canopy of the tropical forests. So the ant will leave the colony, go down to the ground, and then find a leaf that's about 20 to 25 centimeters off the ground and bite the vein of a major vein of the leaf so that the ant holds onto the leaf even after it dies. And the ant will die and the fungus will grow.
And you say something like 20 to 25 centimeters. This is all very specific, and there's been research done into that this sort of happens the same way every time.
Right. So there's a study from some scientists who are working in Thailand, and they found these ants dead on the leaves with the fungus growing out of the back of their head. And all of the ants were about 25 centimeters off the ground. They were all on the underside of the leaf. They were all in areas of high humidity and the right temperature for the fungus to grow. So somehow these have co-evolved so that the insect, or in this case the ant, will end up in the environment that the fungus needs in order to grow and reproduce.
And then the ants themselves can tell something is up.
There has been documentation of ants removing an infected ant from the colony. So they can tell that a fellow ant has been infected and will pick it up and remove it from the colony to save the rest of the colony.
And if there's a case of a widespread infection, the ones that aren't infected will get out.
In the same experiment that showed that all of these ants were about 25 centimeters off the ground, within that area where all these thousands of dead ants were, there were no live ants. So they only saw two live ants of the same species out of thousands of dead ants. So the idea is these ants know where not to be somehow, which makes sense because if the spores are dropping to the ground, the ant does not want to be wandering around where spores are dropping.
There is a specific type of host organism that specific types of this fungus look for.
Right. So there's host specificity is the term that's used, where the host and the fungus are each very specific species. Ophiocordyceps, there are different species in the genus Ophiocordyceps, and each species has a specific host that it will infect. And many of these hosts are insects, other species of ants, caterpillars, larvae of beetles. There's all kinds of insect hosts. There's another species that actually infects another fungus, a false truffle. And so they're all parasitic, but each species has a specific host that it will infect.
And this has been going on for a long time.
Yes. There has been a fossilized leaf found that has evidence of the bite mark. So the mandible of the ant makes a very specific shape bite mark on a leaf when it bites down on the vein. And there's a fossilized leaf that's been dated to 48 million years ago that has this shape of a bite mark on it. So the relationship between the fungus and its host, and this was an ant-like host because of the shape of the mandible, has been going on for millions of years. With your feet on the air, your head on the ground. Try this trick and spin it. Yeah. You have a collapse, but there's nothing in it. And you'll ask yourself, where is my mind? Where is my mind?
Okay, that was creepy. And I know it may be your lunchtime when you're listening to this, so I'm not entirely certain that I can fully promote watching this. But if you are strong of will, check out a time-lapse video at our Facebook page that shows... well, it shows a mushroom growing out of an ant's head. I'm not going to lie. Thanks, Micah.
It's got to be the grossest thing ever on this show. You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. And speaking of turning your stomach, staring at the edge of the fiscal cliff might do it, too. We're joined now by financial advisor Bob Boxall from Centennial Wealth, and he's here to discuss what the fiscal cliff means for you and me. And today he's also got tips on college and retirement savings. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Micah. Some people say there's a fungus growing in Washington these days.
Well, let's start there. Let's start with the fiscal cliff. And maybe as a starting point, just a quick definition of what the fiscal cliff is.
Well, the so-called fiscal cliff is a combination of two things that could very well happen by the end of this year. And that is, number one, the Bush-era tax cuts that have been in place basically since 2001, 2002, are scheduled to end at the end of this year. And what that means basically is that everyone's taxes would go back up about 3 to 5%. The other part is what's called a budget sequester, and that's a term that I think a lot of people are going to hear more of later in the year. If you remember, it was just about 1 year ago at this time when a group of bipartisan members of Congress got together to try to trim spending in order to cut our budget. And I, for one, thought they would work, thought it would succeed. It did not. Nothing came of it. Well, as a result, there is a law that is in place, and as of January 2nd, 2013, $110 billion in government spending has to be cut the way it's written right now. So the cliff is this. If we come to a point where everyone's taxes go up at about the same time that the government spending goes down, well, that's a great way to reduce the deficit. However, with our economy so fragile right now, most economists think it's also a great way to put our country back into recession because people would have a little bit less money to spend and there would be less spending on the government side, losing jobs in that area.
But there's a catch, right? We're in an election year, and
yes,
so everybody's playing politics. So, I mean, does anything surprise you anymore that happens or doesn't happen in Washington financially?
No, we were talking before we went on. I was surprised last year that more did not get done. I really thought this committee, a bipartisan group of good people, would stem this off and make sure that things got settled. It did not. So here we are right now. And I mean, nothing's going to happen even if Congress worked together. And they don't work together, but even in years when they work together, very little would get done in a presidential election year. It's going to be left over for that lame duck Congress in probably early December to make decisions on what happens with all of this. It's going to be a very, very busy lame duck session of Congress.
And those could be stopgap measures, right? I mean, this might not be a big overhaul of our fiscal policy.
Absolutely. And we've seen that before. We feel like we're to the brink of something, and then Congress simply passes a bill, it pushes it back 3 months or so. And I think, honestly, I think that's probably very likely in both of these cases, with the tax cuts and with the spending cuts. I think that they will do their best to push this back to the next Congress that takes over in late January.
So how worried should we be? I mean, you know, we'd be seeing a tax increase effectively, you and I, and everyone else. So how worried should we be about this?
I don't think we should be worried, but I think we should be paying very close attention to the election coming up, because those of us around here have a senator to vote for, have a congressman, and of course, president. So I think it's more important than ever that people take time to pay attention and do more than simply watch TV commercials. That's the worst thing that anybody can do. They need to actually get the facts from both sides, and voting will determine the future in this area.
Well, and Congress, of course, is the body that really has the biggest impact on tax codes and fiscal regulations and so forth. How much does the outcome of the presidential election matter in terms of fiscal policy and tax policy?
Well, I think it can still matter a great deal, because if the White House and Congress are all with one party, then things will get done very quickly, whether it's Republican or Democrat. But if it's split, it's going to be a much slower, much more combative process, I think. And that's what we've seen the last few years.
What about the extension of the temporary payroll tax cut that President Obama introduced? That's been in effect for, what, about a year now?
Right. I think that is scheduled to end next year. So mm-hmm. that is a little bit separate, but it's probably going to be something that comes up at the same time that these other issues regarding the taxes are finally taken care of.
So what do you, when you talk with clients, when you talk with people about tax issues and how that impacts, because that does impact our personal finances, what are the biggest concerns that you hear from people?
Well, I think the biggest concern is simply not knowing. I don't think that people are terribly concerned that their taxes are going to shoot way up. Now, chances are, if anything, taxes are going to go up. If you look historically over the last 50 to 75 years, we are in an era of relatively low tax rates. In fact, very low tax rates compared to the last 50 years or so. So if you look at that, chances are that taxes will go up. But I think most people realize if they do, they're going to go up 3 to 5%. They may, if the Democrats have their way, they probably won't have any changes at all unless they're making $250,000 or more, and then they will go back up 3 to 5%. But I think most people are concerned, and I think this really talks about the business environment also. People are frustrated that companies are making a ton of money but not hiring, but their response is, we just don't know what the near future is going to look like because Washington can't decide. So maybe that's an excuse, but I think there's some legitimacy to that also, that they're waiting to get some guidance from Washington.
That uncertainty limits investment.
It does.
Yeah.
Yep.
We're talking about personal finances and also fiscal matters on a grander scale with Bob Boxall. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Trend.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WNIN proudly presents Next Avenue, a new website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wnin.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part two.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're talking personal finance with financial advisor Bob Boxall from Centennial Wealth. And before we get into more personal finance matters like college savings and retirement savings, I do want to ask you another question about the big picture. And I know that in this election year, there's a lot of rhetoric from both parties about the deficit. And it's maybe worth remembering that just over 10 years ago, we actually had a really huge surplus. And so, how quickly our fortunes can change.
That's true. And I guess that's good, Micah, because we know that even though it's bad right now, it can change very quickly. When in 2001, this country had a budget surplus of $230 billion. And that's really what led to the tax cuts, because we had this surplus money. So we gave it back to taxpayers, basically. But what happened then? Two recessions, two wars. One of those recessions was the Great Recession of 2008, and suddenly we have a deficit nearing $14 trillion. So it shows you just how quickly that money can also evaporate.
And I guess what a dramatic impact fiscal policy and certainly in the case of wars and so forth, foreign policy can make on how much money we've got in the bank.
Right, absolutely. So that's part of what's coming up with the sequester issue in terms of taking money away. And I know the military has been very adamant about saying that if the sequester is allowed to go through, if $110 billion is taken out this year, and then I think it's $1.2 trillion eventually over 10 years that is supposed to come out in order to lower the deficit. But if that happens, the military is really going to be affected. Medicare will be affected in some way. Now, there are some things that are off limits. Social Security, for example, is off limits in this. It's not going to be affected. But just about every other area that depends on government financing is going to be affected in some way.
Well, let's move on to talk a bit about savings here. You've got some workshops or some presentations coming up. You've got one on retirement saving coming up on August 13th at the Evansville Vanderburgh Public Library's McCulloch branch, and then college savings on August 20th. Let's start with college savings. Although I guess they're tied together, because if you've got maybe a 10-year-old child or a 2-year-old child, and you're starting to save for college, you also should be saving for retirement.
Right.
all our budgets, most of our budgets, are crunched to some degree now. We haven't seen a lot of raises in the last few years. How do you balance all of that?
It's very difficult. And when we were sitting down with the folks at the Evansville Vandenberg Public Library, we picked these two topics because I think we all sense that they are two of the most stressful areas of personal finance for most families. People, as you said, they're not making as much money, but they're still trying to plan for retirement at some point. They've also got kids they're trying to put through college. College costs are going up 5, 6, 7% every year. It's a very, very difficult and challenging predicament. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday saying that college costs are now hitting higher income families more than ever. It's actually causing higher income families to think about where their kids are going to school because the costs are so much. And what happens in the end is either the kids or the parents or a combination are left with loans that are getting exorbitant. There's now more college debt than there is credit card debt in this country.
So you've got to balance the amount of debt that you're going to incur getting a degree with how much you're going to earn being employed with that degree.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So that's why we're trying to bring these sessions to the public's assistance. We did a couple of these at Red Bank Library back in July, and they're really popular and I think went over very well. So we're basically doing the same ones at McCullough on Washington Avenue. Monday the 13th is the retirement session, and then on Monday the 20th is the Saving for College session, 6 o'clock each evening at McCullough. It's free. Don't have to call or anything. Just show up. But our intent is to try to lessen the feeling that I can't do this. You know, I can't ever retire. I can't ever save for my kids' college. Yes, you can. You have to have a plan in place, but you don't have to have $1 million to do it. And hopefully we can show some people some steps that can help them along the way.
Let's say you've got room in your budget to put a certain amount away each month for those two things. Do you give one of those priority? Do you split it down the middle? What do you do?
You know, really, I think economists and financial advisors generally agree you want to put your retirement ahead of saving for your kids' college. And I think that probably goes contrary to the feelings most parents have. You know, they just automatically want to take care of their kids first. But there's more flexibility when you're dealing with college costs. There are loans, there are grants. You can pay it off over a certain amount of time. But when you get to retirement, that's it. You've got to have that money set aside already.
No scholarships for when you retire.
Right. You turn 65, you might get Social Security, but you don't get a scholarship. Exactly. So that's why it's important to try to do retirement first. But most families are, regardless, they want to save and help their kids get to college.
You know, we've said 65 is the retirement age for a long time now. Is that going to change?
I think it could. Actually, Medicare has always been 65. That's when people can start taking Medicare. But if you look at Social Security, the actual retirement age for people in their 50s now is not 65, it's 66. For people in their 30s and 20s, it's about 67. So that number has moved progressively upward, and it probably will continue to do so.
And I guess that stays in line to some degree with our increasing life expectancies.
It does. And as we try to find ways to sustain programs such as Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, I think it's certainly possible that you could see those ages stretched out a little bit further.
One of the big issues as one, hopefully much later in one's retirement, but it is the issue of nursing home care and the costs there. You talk about college costs going up, much the same in terms of long-term care.
Right. And in fact, we've got a program on August 21st. Rebecca Vaughn, who heads the Indiana Department of Insurance Long-Term Care Program, is coming back to Evansville. She was here in March, and we had a really good turnout for that. A lot of people came out to listen to her speak, but she'll talk about the Indiana partnership. Long-term care is very costly, but if it's handled correctly, people can afford it. But it's a tough decision for families to make. She makes it a little bit simpler to understand, and she also talks about how the partnership works. And basically what that does is if you buy long-term care insurance under the Indiana Partnership, you are guaranteed to keep a certain amount of your assets, even if you go through all of your insurance. Mm-hmm. And one concern for families is they want to leave some kind of a legacy for their heirs, for their kids or their grandkids. They want to leave some money. But what happens is when people go into nursing homes, their money just evaporates. It goes fast. The average price of a nursing home stay is about $65,000 a year. So the money goes away fast. With long-term care insurance, you're able to preserve your assets, and that can help a lot of families.
So really, these are all tools tools for retirement saving, tools for college saving. One has to, I guess, come back to what you said earlier. You have to have a plan.
You really do. Yeah, it takes a little time, not too much though. But it takes a little time to make sure you do have a plan. Understand what your possibilities are, what might work for you, what might not work for you. But at least you've understood those possibilities, and that makes everybody a little bit smarter.
Bob Boxall is a financial advisor with Centennial Wealth, and he's got those presentations coming up on August 13th and 20th at the McCullough Branch, and also the presentation on August 21st at Centennial Wealth. So thanks so much for your time, Bob.
Thanks, Mike. Enjoyed it.
Support for WNIN comes from contributing listeners and also through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stimptonago family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting. Support also comes from the Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for over 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org.
You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and it's time, after a one-week hiatus, it's time once again for the Arts Notebook with Roger McBain from the Courier and Press. Hi, Roger.
Good afternoon.
And Roger, there's something for everyone in today's Arts Notebook. We've got a whole slew of things to run through, and let's start with a brand new music festival taking place in Evansville this weekend.
It's called Music on the Hill. It's a new event at the Wesselman Woods Nature Center, and it runs tomorrow from noon to 8 p.m. Five acoustic music acts from Evansville, New Harmony, and Bloomington, Indiana. Some art there, paintings, prints, photography, jewelry, soaps by four local artists, food by the River City Food Co-op, and beer and wine by Taroni's. $5 admission for those 12 and older. Tomorrow.
All right, over at Wesselman Woods. It sounds like a fun time. And speaking of music festivals this weekend, there's also the annual Bluegrass in the Park Folklife Festival in Henderson. And I just love this. It's such an unusual pairing. There's a pole vaulting competition just down the street from that.
I just looked at that online today. That's amazing. There's some like former Olympians in that pole vaulting tomorrow night.
I saw the Jamaican national champion last year.
Yeah, but it's it runs 7 to midnight, 7 a.m. to midnight Saturday, 5 to 11 p.m. today. A dozen bands from three states. There's a bike tour, a disc golf, and this pole vaulting, and it's all free down at Riverfront Park.
Okay, let's stick with musical events. How about this series called Arts in August?
Trinity United Methodist Church on Southeast 2nd Street in Evansville has been doing this for years. Sunday at 3 p.m., they're going to have jazz. Eric Scales, Pat Moore, and members of the After Hours Ensemble will play at 3 p.m. August 19th, organ and keyboard recital by Thomas Drury with soprano Andrea Drury. And on the 26th, harpist Mary Dickin, flutist Shauna Thompson, and violist Brian St. John at 3 p.m. Free, free will offering.
Okay, and there's even more music, if we look a little later in the month, and this sounds like a wonderful combination, ice cream and singing.
Yeah, it's a Sunday, as in ice cream Sunday, sing-along at St. Stephen's Church in New Harmony. Randy Pease, Liz, and Bishop Mumford will lead a sing-along from that great songbook, Rise Up Singing, which has, I think, 1,200 songs, words, and chords to these folk songs, standards, all kinds of things.
That's going to be a very long event.
Well, they get to choose from it. And then they'll serve ice cream, $1 a scoop. I think it would take some alcohol for me to get singing with them, but you can get ice cream sundaes for $1 a scoop, and it's free otherwise.
Yeah, just what your vocal cords need, and a scoop of ice cream. The now there's the Wolfgang Orchestra and Chorus, which also has concerts scheduled in Evansville, Mount Vernon, and New Harmony.
It's a 75-member community orchestra and chorus led by Dennis and Nancy Noon in Mount Vernon. August 24th, 7:30 p.m., they'll be at First United Methodist Church in Mount Vernon. 7:30 p.m. August 25th, New Harmony's Murphy Auditorium. 6:30 August 26th in Evansville at American Baptist East. Free, donations welcome.
All right. And now let's move on to visual arts. This is neat. Evansville's Victory Theater gets to relive what I think was its original purpose or function, which is as a movie house.
That's correct. These are the movies on Main Street, which went to Main Street when Mesker Amphitheater closed this summer because of needed repairs. But this, it's air conditioned. You don't have to worry about rainouts. Friday the 17th, it will be the Three Stooges, the 2012 remake of the silly movies from back when. And then Saturday the 18th, We Bought a Zoo with Matt Damon. I think it was a 2011 movie about a family that buys a zoo.
Yeah. And how does it's free to get in, right? But there are passes available?
There are passes available from various sponsors. They've always been available online as well, which I think they'll probably do again. You can but if you go into smg.org online, and I think that's what it is, smg.org, mm-hmm. but Google it or look in my story.
Yes.
to find out how to do it. But you can get passes to it. You can get in there free.
Okay. And then finally, a new exhibition of woodworks is open at the Evansville Museum.
Up in the Alcove Gallery, John McNaughton, retired USI professor and sculptor who has work across the country, including the Smithsonian Institution, and all over the city, including in front of the center and hanging from the ceiling in Central Library, that book tree.
Oh, sure.
He did that as well. There's an exhibition of his work up there. And while we're talking about the museum, they are looking for volunteer docents to get the inside scoop on all the shows that are there and lead tour groups, students and adults through the museum. So they're having a luncheon on the 20th, 9:30 to 11:30 a.m.
Okay, so you can become a docent at the museum. Roger McBain's articles, if you feel overwhelmed by the volume of information we've presented, you can find it all in print in the Evansville Courier and Press and online at courierpress.com. Roger, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, next week we'll talk about how we talk about climate change, what language actually changes our behavior, and we'll talk about balancing hope with doom and gloom. Plus, we'll discuss what role cities can play in the health of their residents. You can connect with The Trend by clicking on The Trend at WNIN.org. You'll find links for getting in touch on Facebook, Twitter, and email. You'll also find podcasts there and at CourierPress.com, and we're on iTunes and in the NPR podcast directory. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer at the Courier and Press. Tony Voss is our associate producer. Steve Berger engineered today's show. Jeffrey Osman composed the theme music. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.